Social Flight is brought to you by Aspen Avionics, Avidyne, Continental Aerospace Technologies, Lightspeed Aviation, Tempest Aero Group, and Whip Air. And now, here's your host, Jeff Simon.
Welcome to Cockpit to Cowl, the show that explores general aviation safety topics from the combined perspective of flight instructors, pilots, and mechanics, exploring both pilot and aircraft topics to make aviation safer and more enjoyable. I'm Jeff Simon, a pilot, AMP, IA, and president of Social Flight.
I'm Brian Schiff. I've been flight instructing actively for over 40 years and flying for the airlines to help support my airplane for about 35 years.
How are you doing tonight, Brian?
I'm doing all right. Good to see you. How are you?
I am wonderful. Just got back from Sun and Fun, which was a blast.
I missed that. I haven't gone to Sun and Fun yet. Done Oshkosh a lot. I still have yet to make Sun and Fun.
And it was wonderful. You know, very, very hot this year, but absolutely wonderful. Got to meet lots of folks out there, many of whom are probably in the audience tonight because they told me that they are. And just had a wonderful time. So hope to get out there with you again next time. But I do want to talk about something that was really fascinating. We made a bunch of videos out there. If you haven't already gone and checked out Social Flight's YouTube channel, please go just type in one word, Social Flight as one word in YouTube, and it'll come up there. But one of the things that was really interesting to me and fits with tonight's show is that when we talked to Avemco, they were going and giving us a lot of insight, and I know they've sent you the same data, and you and I have been talking about this, that nearly 20% of their claims happen on the ground. And I find that really, really fascinating. So we made a video that you can check out there called Your Hangar Wants to Hurt You. And,
I'm laughing from experience.
Yeah. And I think, you know, when you talk about landings and ground handling and things like that, it is, can you imagine when you think about that, nearly 20%, that if I just were, you know, using some really rough math, I would say our rates could be nearly 20% lower if we just paid a little bit more attention on the ground, if everyone did, including pushing it back into a hangar, taxiing, starting up with the tow bar attached. Oh my, so many things.
I think most pilots get a pretty good sense of importance of for safety in the air, a good regard for safety. But on the ground, it's like, well, I'm on the ground, I'm safe. What could possibly go wrong here? And they just maybe let loose a little bit as far as how careful they are. And it just happens way too much.
It is fascinating to me. It's like literally that one of the most risky parts of your flight is pushing back into a hangar or pushing back into a tie down or just getting started. I mean, you've mentioned to me that you have some standard operating procedures. I know you're going to be talking about that in one of your upcoming shift show episodes. Yes. Tell me a little bit about this, because I'll tell you, from the work that I do, I see so many issues from people where they say, I started with the tow bar or the tug attached. And that's bad, bad, bad news.
Yeah, it's almost like you've got to figure, you know, it's the one you don't see that gets you. So you've got to always be looking for what is going to go wrong, what could go wrong. You know, if I set my glass on the edge of the table, what could possibly go wrong with that versus in the middle of the table? I have one of my students open the hangar door to pull the airplane out, and he pulled it enough that said, this should be enough. Well, I open the hangar doors, and one of my policies, as you say, is to open the hangar doors all the way. I know that there's enough room if I open it all the way. If you open them partway and say, there's probably enough room, that's not good enough, and you don't know exactly what that number is. So it's kind of a mindset and a philosophy that you need to gain for maximum safety. How hard is it to open the hangar doors a few more feet? How hard is it to keep the airplane tail away from the hangar door before you swing it open? And when I was 16 years old, that's the one that I did. It was a T-hanger where the middle section opened up like that. And I got too close to the hangar and I pushed it open right into the rudder of the airplane. You know, little policies like, why do we make a 90 degree turn at the hangar so we don't have to turn it when we push it back in the hangar? Well, a policy never to do that is also a good policy, because that 90 degree turn is where a lot of bad things happen.
Absolutely. And if you have people with you, give them a job, right? Watch the wingtip, watch the tail, yell, scream, stop, do whatever you got to do.
Right. And every time an airplane goes taxiing past mine that might be sticking out of the hangar or my car parked next to the hangar, if I hear an airplane, I'm out there watching it. Whether or not it's obvious that there's enough room or not, I'm there giving the pilot a thumbs up if there's enough room and watching it. It's just a state of security for a pilot to see someone watching their wingtip, giving them a thumbs up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was thinking back on, you know, when we were all kids, right? The little bikes, you always used to get a big flag on it so you could be seen by traffic. I want to see tugs have that. Like, I don't care how small your tug is. It needs a big flag.
Not at Jeff's airport. There goes Jeff again.
That's right. So you don't do it. On a very serious note, though, I do want to say to people out there, there is no real such thing as a benign hit to a stationary object with your propeller. If you go to start the engine and it turns over and gets a hard ding when it hits an attached tow bar, an attached tug, that's a big, big deal. You've put a sudden stoppage in the engine. And I've talked to some contacts that I know that work at engine shops and do teardowns. And the one thing that they say to me is, it is unpredictable, that there are times that you see something that should be incredibly minor, and when they open up the engine, they find major damage. And there are other times that you see a pretty significant ding in the prop, and you think, oh man, I probably messed something up. And then they find everything's okay. And it's unpredictable enough that you're putting your life at risk if you go and get a substantial ding on that prop from putting it to a dead stop. And then you can't just pretend this is okay and walk away, because it also has damage, could be damaging accessories, could damage the very fragile distributor block and plastic gears or you know, phenolic gears that are in the magnetos.
The what? Oh, gears?
Just a message. Yeah.
Yeah. I saw that. I think you showed in one of your videos from Sun and Fun, the parts of a magneto. You were visiting this magneto manufacturer and showing all those. And I had no idea that those gears were plastic. And yeah, kind of motivated me, okay, I'm going to get my 500-hour inspection done. But yeah.
Yeah. So be out there. Be careful on the ground, I guess. That's the last message about this. Be careful on the ground so you help yourself, you improve your safety, and you keep your insurance rates down. Thank you so much to Avemco for really opening up about what their claims are and what kind of things they're seeing on a regular basis. That really helps. And if you want to save 5% on your Avemco insurance, just mention Social Flight and they'll give you a 5% discount. So
yeah, just imagine
if we could
cut out that many, you know, ground damages. And you can't just say just real quickly, to your point about the prop just hit something and stopped, it's that continuation bias that we've got to watch out for. We can talk ourselves into going by saying, it'll probably be okay. Is that good enough? Like, if you're in the back of my airplane and I'm on an airliner and I make a PA announcement to all my passengers that, well, we just had a little hiccup with our engine, but we're probably going to be okay. Picture that.
Show of hands in the back. Who would rather try to get there so you're not late, and who's okay becoming a possible glider at some point?
Right, right. I hope to never have to use a claim from Avemco, but it's comforting knowing that they're there.
Well, I want to hop right into this. And Brian, I am dying to learn from you this episode. Help me. Correct me if I'm wrong, but in my experience, the only thing people care about who are your passengers is, did you grease the landing? It doesn't matter. Yeah. You could run out of gas. It doesn't matter what happens the rest of the flight. They don't care about anything. They only judge you on how you grease the landing. So are you going to tell me how to do that?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I'm going to give the secret away. In fact, I was kind of thinking, should I do it? Should I not give the secret away? If I do this, then I'm not going to look any better than anybody else if everybody's out there greasing landings. But yeah, if I have my passengers get off, if I made a greaser, they think I might have just totally screwed up and accidentally took off with one engine instead of two and blah, blah. But if I grease that landing, boy, everything's fine. Everything, and then they just love the flight. Great flight, great landing. Yeah, your entire piloting skills are judged by that one moment of touchdown.
Nice job. Nice job.
Yeah, exactly. So you're right. It's for some reason we take a lot of pride in that too. And also the ego goes when you make a bad landing, but they happen. And I will give away the trick. I'll give away some techniques that I teach that have really made it easier for a lot of my students that have made less, given an aha moment when they're trying to learn to land. I've had students come to me that, but for the landing, they'd be ready to solo. Everything else, maneuvering, flying the airplane's fine, but the landing is no good. So what can you do? Go to Brian. Brian will show you and get you landing perfectly. And I guess I will give away the secret. Maybe what we do, we could open a kitty and we could give away the secret for how to make the perfect landing every time to those who donate a certain dollar amount. No, I mean, it's okay. I'll tell you the secret. The one thing, this is the one thing, I'll just lead with it. And then, you don't have to hang on for the whole webinar, because if you get this, you're going to be making great landings every time.
And you Navy carrier pilots out there, no need, you don't need to even be on the show, right?
Right.
Stick
It's a
this.
different technique. Yeah. How are your landings, Jeff? They always grease them on?
When no one's looking, they're
Yeah.
perfect.
When no one's on board, they're always perfect. I've made my best landings from the flight engineer seat when I was like, the third guy in the cockpit watching them. I'm like, I know exactly what I would have done to make that landing better. I've had some landings that were so bad that we dropped the oxygen masks in the back of the airplane. The first time I ever had my now wife, then girlfriend on the flight was in Colorado Springs, but it was a, I would call it a wind shear recovery, not a landing. But in any event, it dropped the oxygen masks, and I could actually hear the flight attendant scream. And those will try a pilot's ego. So to make a perfect landing every time, I mean, this is really all you have to do. And you're going to be like, oh, no one told me that. And it's just so simple. But, and my dad taught me this, so I'm going to give credit where credit's due. So thanks, Dad, for that. All you have to do to make the perfect landing is just get the airplane down to about a quarter inch to an inch off the ground and level off right there. And then just ease it on. That's it.
That does make perfect sense, right? I mean, as long as we can just get go from a quarter inch down, the rest of it is up to you.
Right. No, so I mean, all in seriousness though, you've heard a lot of sayings like a good approach leads to a good landing, and there's a lot of truth to that, because when you're stabilized, when you're everything's ready and stable for the approach, and you're not making a lot of changes at the end, you're ready to make a good landing. And so I have seen in my experience doing lots of pattern work with students that if the approach is good, the landing is generally going to be good. So you need to be on speed and don't tolerate anything other than that. And don't be too fast. I've seen more accidents or botched up landings from pilots who are flying too fast than I have from being too slow. If we're flying our VREF, it's 30% above the stalling speed. That's a significant margin. And if it's gusty, we'll add half the gust factor to that. So if it's 10 knots gusting to 16, we have a 6 knot gust. So add 3 knots to that, maybe 4 knots or 5 knots. And then what pilots will do is they'll add 10 knots, and they got all this speed and they're coming over the fence. And now you get down there and you want to put it on the ground where you normally put it on the ground, but the airplane's not ready to land yet. You're still going too fast. So you float, float, float down the runway, burning off all this energy. You either are going to land all the way down the runway and while you're bleeding off the speed, or you're going to force it on too soon and get into the, oscillations that you see all, pilot-induced oscillations on the wheel bearing you see on YouTube videos that are kind of fun to watch. But so be on speed, be on target speed, know what speed you're going to fly. And what I always make my students tell me, okay, even a flight review, what speed are you going to target on approach? Because I want to watch to see that you maintain that speed. You right nail it. And just asking them and having them tell me the target seems to make them stay on speed. Most of the time, pilots develop the bad habit of just being somewhere in the range on landing. Somebody, if your VREF is 75, they might be between 70 and 80 or 85, and then just bleed it off. And with a long runway, that might be okay, but you probably, every landing is a different feel when you don't have a consistent airspeed. It's also very important to be ready and willing to abandon the approach, to go around, to be basically planning on doing the go around. Like, hey, if I don't like what I see, I'm doing a go around. Don't get committed to the landing. Don't commit yourself to this is, you know, you're already seeing the end of the flight. Plan on going around unless everything works out perfectly and interrupts your plan to do the go around. And then you say, okay, well, everything looks good. I'm just going to change my plan and land the airplane. So that's an important thing, a kind of a mindset of just being ready to abandon if needed, if it just doesn't look good. There's no shame in going around. And sometimes, arguably, you could say it's fun and you get more flying time.
Yeah. Help me with a little bit on the yeah. crosswind side, because we've all learned different techniques and then how to combine and blend those different techniques of slipping versus crab and kind of tell me a little bit about how you do it.
So how I do it is I will fly whatever heading it takes to keep the airplane over the extended center line. Imagine that extended center line coming all the way up the final approach. Get the airplane over the top of that. Keep it coordinated with your ball centered and fly whatever heading it takes, obviously pointed a little bit crabbing into the wind, as you said. The airplane doesn't know it's flying sideways. It's just flying straight through a body of air that happens to be moving sideways. And that's where we get this vision where we're flying sideways or crabbing, so to speak, over the ground. How now you can't touch down like that. So this is where the problem comes. What I will do when I'm training a student to do this for the first time is we will kick out the crab, so to speak. We will align the longitudinal axis of the airplane up with the runway, so it's parallel. And now if you just kick the rudder, so imagine this, you're flying, why use my hand? I have toys. Right. So imagine you're flying, you know, crooked, you're crabbing toward the runway, but you're totally coordinated and you are got the wind going, you know, straight ahead of the aircraft. That whole air mass happens to be moving as well. So you're approaching the runway like this, and then first step is to kick out the crab and just push the rudder so that your aileron, so that your longitudinal axis is parallel to the runway. When that happens, now you know if you do nothing else, you're going to start going off to the side. So now that you've got it lined up, you want to now just use your wings and aileron to fly it over the center line, wherever it needs to be. So you're holding this left rudder and just fly it. To do that, I don't try to give a bank angle or any specific numbers, just fly it with the aileron. Lock that rudder to keep the longitudinal axis parallel to the runway. Everything else, the elevator is the same, even though you might be holding some aileron. To keep it lined up, and then you're just going to flare and touch down on that upwind wheel first. The newer you are, the earlier you start that. Later in your flying, as you get accustomed to crosswind landings, you'll do that later and later, like you probably do it pretty close to the flare, I would think.
Oh, I'm doing it usually just before the touchdown.
Yeah, my, to come in goal, and yeah. Yeah, if you line it up and hold the wing down and do this slip all the way from 500 feet down, you're adding a lot of drag. You're going to come down steeper. It's going to take more power. There's nothing wrong with that. It's another technique. And sometimes it helps students or people who are having trouble with the crosswind to do that first. Mm-hmm. Also, what I'll do with the students having trouble with crosswinds or when I first teach it is we don't plan to land. We just plan to fly over the runway. I want you to see how this airplane is moving in this air mass. So we're going to fly over the runway and just keep it over the center line and keep your ball centered. So keep the aircraft coordinated. And you'll see that you're just flying like this and you might have to make turns to keep it over the runway, but just fly over the runway. That's all we're going to do, like 20 feet over the runway, down the full length, request a low approach or the option. And do that. So we'll do that a few times and then we'll come in and I'll say, okay, now this time I want you to practice lining up the longitudinal axis with the runway and do whatever you have to do to fly down all the way down the length of the runway, but don't land it. And we're just going to do that a couple times and get the feel for that cross controlling that seems so unnatural and pilots have a hard time with that. But you see, okay, it's very controllable. It's just a little cattywampus, so to speak, with you're holding that rudder and one wing down. And holding some control wheel aileron in or stick into it. But then that's like your new neutral. And then you just flare and land. Very important not to take those control inputs out once you land. Like, don't give up the landing of the airplane. Like, you don't get all relaxed once you touch down. That's just where the fun begins, especially if you're in a tail dragger. Now, if you want to really learn how to land an airplane and get good at it in the tri-school gear, go get a tailwheel checkout, which I think we're going to go have some fun with that soon, aren't we?
Yes, we are. We're definitely going to do that. You know, as I mentioned, when I land, I tend to hold the crab until the very last minute before touchdown. And then my goal, and this is somewhat because I'm always thinking about my tires, and so I want to kick it out at the last minute and then touchdown tracking straight and not, you know, eat up or you know, flat spot my tires, just be able to go down there in that wave. Now, I'm still using aileron at that point. I want to pretend like that's not happening at all, because you have to fly the airplane on the ground too. And and so we're doing that, even just, especially in a very, very strong crosswind, even just to hold it on.
One of the things, and that's a very good point. I like to point out to students exactly what you said. You can't touch down. The wheels roll, you know, evenly. You know, they roll in one plane. They don't roll sideways. If you touch down sideways, you're going to skid, and you put a lot of side load on that landing gear. Boy, you talk about a lot of YouTube videos that are hilarious watching crosswind. Just look up, you know, crosswind landings on YouTube, and you'll see all kinds of videos how not to do it. And you can see that airplane touches down sideways, you're putting side loads on it.
Oh,
and what would have been, I know it hurts to watch, what would have been a greaser, even if you were just like beautiful greaser, would feel like a hard landing when you get that side load.
Yeah.
A lot of pilots are also apprehensive about landing on one wheel first, especially new pilots, because that feels like you're doing some kind of stunt flying or trickery. But it's really not. You're holding that wing, the lift, into the wind as you flare and touch down, hold that aileron and keep that aileron in through the landing roll and all the way to the hangar.
And if you can landing stay, to be fair, if you can stay on that one wheel all the way to the hangar, well, that actually is impressive. That is definitely a trick flying.
Yeah, then you're going to have be one of those claims for a VEMCO for the ground collision, probably, if you try taxiing in like that.
You know, there's a single runway at the airport I fly into in Minuteman in Stowe, and tends to get a lot of crosswinds. It just happens to be the alignment of the runway versus where prevailing wind is. And yeah, you can see the difference between people understanding to do that. And sometimes you'll see folks come in and touch down without kicking out that crab. And that is quite traumatic. A lot of people sort of have this idea that once you do it, the airplane will straighten itself out, and to some degree it will. But that's not what it's there for.
Yeah, so then we're going to get to this a little later, but then you're going to have like, okay, this is what, how do I know if that's happened to some, you know, I rent airplanes, pilots are landing it in a crab and putting this side load on it. How do I pre-flight it? What do I look for? And that's the problem with renting, is you don't know, you know, and people aren't going to want to fess up. It's human nature to hide what they've done.
We'll get to that a little bit in a bit. What I really want to ask you, a couple things. One is, and this is a serious question, you know, if you go to like Oshkosh, you see people landing one after the other trying to point at certain dots on the runway. It seems to echo what we see at regular airports if you watch a lot of landings happen, and that is, for some reason, pilots who are trying to put it down early, in some cases float for quite a bit. You see, they get the opposite. Other pilots that need to go, if you watch any Oshkosh, they're like, no, go further, I want you on this other dot. And they're touching down early. It almost seems like there's something that has you doing the opposite of what you're really trying to accomplish.
Because you mean you want to touch it down at a certain point or early, but they don't make it?
Whatever it is, I've just seen a lot of cases where people are like, okay, we want to bring it in, and then they're floating a long distance when they wanted to hit at the end, when they want to actually, if they have more runway, they're plopping it early on. It seems to be what you focus on that tends to affect you.
It does. And basically, you know, when I teach instruments and I want someone to hold their altitude, I say, don't look at your altimeter. If I want you to maintain an airspeed, I cover up the airspeed indicator. Basically, what I want you doing is putting the airplane where you know it should be to get what you want out of it. You know how to maintain altitude. You know how to hold a heading. Don't bank. Be coordinated. So when it comes to landing, you need to know where to put the airplane, and a master of his or her craft can put the airplane. You ever watch the stall takeoff and landing contests? It's possible to put the airplane exactly where you want it, right? It just takes some practice. It takes some mastery, and it takes, like I mentioned before, speed control. You need to be at the same airspeed so you know exactly how that airplane is going to behave every time. And one of the things that I like you have said before, know the difference of how the aircraft will behave if you have four people in it versus when you only have one person. When people go to Oshkosh, they're loaded up. You know, they're usually heavier than they normally are when they fly, and things are a lot different. So practice knowing where you're going to aim for. So an aim point is very important. And I get this question a lot, like, how do you know? You're just on a glide coming down toward the runway. How do you know where the airplane is trajectory? Where's the trajectory for that airplane right now? And it's actually pretty simple. And if you kind of equate to your car, everything that you see in your car that moves off to the left side of the window and moves past you on the side, your trajectory was to the right of that. Everything that moves right in your windshield and eventually passes past your right window, well, your trajectory is to the left of that. Anything not moving in your windshield, left or right, the car is heading straight toward. So now we take that, turn it 90 degrees, and we have the same thing for up and down. If the target is moving, anything moving up on the window as you approach it is going to go past you, over you, you know, you're going to be short of it. Anything moving down in the window, you're going to overfly. So you're looking for that point that just kind of stays stationary. And sometimes I'll take a dry erase and have the student put a dot on the thing that they think is not moving while they're flying an approach, and watch the dot, watch that thing behind the dot, and see, is it moving up or down? It's not moving at all. That's your trajectory, is right. The thing that is not moving in your windshield.
Yeah.
And you'll get used to seeing that. The more you look at it, the more practice you get, and it becomes natural after you do it a lot.
So I want to get your thoughts on what seems to make the biggest difference between the greasers that the kids are still sleeping in the back, and the embarrassing ones, or the ones you feel really bad about. And that, it seems to be all about the flare and yeah, where that flare happens. And I'll tell you something really interesting that I have no explanation for.
Yeah.
And that is, well, first of all, I'll say, when I learned how to fly, I had this wonderful, wonderful instructor. Was a guy had been around everywhere, state trooper here in Massachusetts, that taught me, John McCory, wonderful guy. And he used to say, you look at the numbers. And then he told me, hey, here's this point where all I want you to do is stop looking at the numbers and look at the end of the runway. He didn't tell me anything to do with the controls. He just said, this is right at this point, you stop looking at the numbers, you now look at the end of the runway. And miraculously, that just happened to work for me. I have found that, for example, when I fly at night, they just grease on. I don't know why. I'm so hyper focused or whatever it is, that's fine. Daytime, put a bunch of people on the plane or do whatever, a bunch of witnesses, I'll screw up night, whatever. But for some reason, when I'm focused at night, when you would think that I can't perceive the exact height I'm at, especially, you know, the airport I fly at most often is a little bit of a black hole, carrier landing.
Well, yeah, and the reason for that, there's a very logical reason for that.
Oh, first please of all, tell me.
I don't know why you don't just get it down to about a quarter inch off the ground, level off, and then just ease it on. No, at night, you're forced to use your peripheral vision some more because you can't see, you know, it's like the runway is black. It's a dark black hole. You can't see anything. There's nothing to look at so much. And so you tend to use your peripheral more. I have my students look down at the far end of the runway because that's where they, you know, there's a great book where they talk about, what is it, The Art of Racing in the Rain, where he says the car goes where your eyes go. And the airplane sort of does the same thing. When you get down to that point, yes, transition toward looking at the end of the runway, but don't stop seeing what's on the side. See your periphery. Okay, so look at the end of the runway so you know where it is. That's your focus point, but see what's happening out here. And what you'll see is the horizon coming up, and you'll see it coming up faster when you get closer. So two instructors I really like that I'm still learning from, Rod Machado and Jason Miller, who will be on the Shift Show in a couple months, have techniques. Now, Rod Machado got one that as soon as I saw this, I started teaching it, and it was very helpful. And that is that when you get to the point where you're supposed to flare, the runway blossoms. And I just want to show a video of this because this is a really neat technique that, and Rod said this was fine to use, but I want to give him the credit, that when you get down to about 8 to 10 feet, the runway is growing and growing and growing, but at one point, it exponentially starts growing even faster. And when you see that point, that's the time to flare. And this is helpful for people with mechanical minds who, you know, learn a little bit more mechanically and kind of need that. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to show a short video of what I'm talking about. Is it sharing the screen? I think it is.
It's about to be.
Yeah. Okay. Do you see the words cockpit decal?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So I'm going to show a video. Basically, he's narrating this. And if you go to YouTube, you can watch the entire video. It's a great lesson of how the blossoming effect of the runway when you get down to about 8 or 10 feet. So you can see the runway is growing. And the point that's not moving in the windshield is the one you're heading towards. It looks like the second or third, you know, this line on the center line here. But at one point, about 8 feet, the runway just, wow, there right about there, just now starts blossoming. And that's the time you need to flare, put the nose up, hold it up, put it out on the horizon, lift the nose up and hold it off, trade that altitude for airspeed. Don't let that airplane touch down until it's ready to touch down. And when you run out of airspeed, it'll ease on down. But generally, you will do this a few times. And I've found that this really does help a lot of pilots. Jason Miller uses the technique of the Lindbergh reference, he calls it. And if you know the Lindbergh, when Charles Lindbergh flew across the Atlantic, he didn't have, windows. He didn't have a front windshield, but he could see a little bit out the side here. Well, there's the part of the glare shield that comes down, and you get a little part of your window here that gives you a little bit of view of the runway when you're in the flare and the nose is high. And the beauty of that is that's what he calls the Lindbergh reference when you're looking at that, because you can, I don't like looking at that. I like looking at the end of the runway, but be aware that it's there and see it. And you will see the runway right there. And it'll give you an idea when you're looking at both of them, it should be the same distance for wings level, but also gives you a good idea when to flare. But being aware of that little place where you can kind of see the runway in your periphery is very helpful. So those are two techniques that really do work, but that blossom effect, next time you go flying, try it, you'll see.
I'll definitely check that out. And again, it really seemed between the, we're right now talking about like, you know, better and best, between better landings and best landings. The difference really is about, are you flaring too high? Are you flaring too low?
So yeah.
It's all about what's happening in that flare.
Yeah. And so another trick for the flare there is be in trim, be on speed, be in trim. You need to be able to fingertip while you're flying. It'd be so in trim that you could let go at a moment's notice. That airplane's got to be in trim, and you should be just flying with your fingertips. If I see a pilot squeezing the life out of the yoke, I make them let go, or I'll put a pencil in their hand, and if they squeeze too hard, it hurts. But I want you flying with your fingertips and not flying with two hands like this. Your other hand needs to be on the throttle. If you take your hand off the throttle and you're flying with me, I'll pull it back. Get your hand back on the throttle. But so if you're in trim and then you just look outside and use your peripheral vision to see the horizon as it's kind of coming up to you, that's when you do it smoothly. And when I see pilots that are just doing this, I mean, it's like pig wrestling. I mean, they're just flying this thing like crazy and they're creating their own turbulence. I had a first officer last month doing that on an airliner. I said, would you please just let go? And he let go, and it was smooth as glass.
Would you? You know what? We have an open seat in first class if you'd like to go back.
Yeah, right. But don't create your own turbulence. Just have it in trim, be on speed. Learn how to do that at altitude. If you're going up practicing by yourself, practice that at altitude of getting it on approach speed in trim so you can just let go.
Yeah.
If it was working at 1,000 feet, it's going to work at the ground too. Don't go jockeying, but people get ground shy and start, you know, just working too hard at it. Be smooth. Stop jerking the controls around. Be smooth and slowly flare and watch and see. Look at the end of the runway, but see the horizon out the side.
You know, it's interesting that you talk about that, because that is exactly, I think, what's so important to in terms of things like even setting up your crab, as we talked about. I know what my crab is going to have to be to track straight on the downwind. That's when I know it. I don't wait for the final and wait to everything else. I can actually tell what's going on with the wind there and then plan to know how strong this is going to be, even though you're at different altitudes. But you said something else that I think is really interesting about the blossoming. That may even be the answer as to why, for me, my night landings seem to grease out better than my day landings. And it's because that moment of a blossoming runway is more dramatic at night with that, with my landing light. It all, again, I'm flying into a very, dark airport at night. Nothing, this isn't not a lot of taxiways or anything. And you come in, and then there's this moment when you get there, and now here come the numbers. It all lights up from your landing light, and it's like, okay, now I go into the flare. It all just seems to work out.
That's true. And I've had students try that without the landing light, and it makes a big difference, especially because the runway lights are maybe a foot off the ground. So they'll flare a foot off the ground and level off like the ground is a foot higher. And it all works out great and it looks beautiful, but then when the airplane finally stalls, it settles 1 foot, and that 1 foot sometimes is all it takes. Quarter inch, just quarter inch off the ground, then just
That's
ease
all you
it
have to
on.
do. That's all you. I love that.
It's all you have to do. I saw some people in the chat mentioning they're going to Alaska in 3 weeks, and those of you who said that, I'm looking forward to seeing you there. And I saw a couple comments about tail draggers as well, because we mentioned that. That will improve your skills, certainly. My first lesson, and when you come to do your tailwheel training, lesson one is going to be at Target or Walmart, your choice. And we're going to fill up the shopping cart full of water, cases of water, turn it around and push it around the store backwards.
Oh, I got that. I used to push a Grumman around from the back, so I'm sorry,
Yeah, so
but I
you,
gotta tell
yeah,
you
there
right up
you.
front, I'm gonna ace that, no question, and I'm gonna totally screw up flying a tailwheel. So we will see how that actually
No, you're
pans
not. You're going to love it. You're
out.
absolutely going to love it. You're just going to realize you can't relax your feet. That's all. You're just pushing a shopping cart backwards. You're just constantly making little corrections to keep it from turning around. And then if you push it and let go, that's what'll happen to the tail dragger if you let go with your feet, which we can all
Perfect.
picture.
So let's talk a little bit about some things that have to do with maintenance stuff having to do with landings. I was talking to someone down at Sun and Fun, and they were telling me a story about this was a shared aircraft, and this is a little bit of my, on one hand, I adore clubs and partnerships and all of that because I want to make flying something that's attainable for everyone. So I fully support that stuff. On the other hand, one of my pet peeves is to be so careful of the dangers when other people are flying, when there's a group of people flying a single aircraft. And that it goes back to human nature, which is it's already bad enough for some of us when we make a mistake to somehow come to terms for ourselves that we have made a mistake and accept it, that the prop hit the tow bar, or that you had a hard landing that was really hard, and you may have to do something about it. It seems to ratchet up another notch from there when the stakes now are that you have to fess up to someone else.
Yeah, and people tend to not want to do that, but they say pride goeth before something. But yeah, if I have someone else flying my airplane, and I do have a couple people who fly it, I say, look, there is no pride. I have screwed up. I'll tell you about my screw ups. Why? Because I want you to admit it when you screw up. For everybody's safety, please let me know if you landed hard, if you landed sideways. These are required write-ups at the airline if we land a hard landing or more than so many G's at landing. In fact, flying the Airbus, that airplane will turn me in if I make a touchdown exceeding so many feet per minute. I don't know what the number is. I try not to find out.
Yeah, well, this that makes a lot of sense. And so this story, this individual, I believe it was Cessna 210 they were talking about. And they went to taxi out to take off, and something didn't feel right during taxi. This it felt like a vibration, a little bit of a knocking. Something wasn't adding up. And this person is a mechanic, and they were wise enough to say, not going to just continue this way. Turned around, went back, and started inspecting what was going on. It turns out that their partner had had a hard landing. And so they, well, let me back up. They inspected, and what they found was a broken, like they call it sometimes like a bathtub fitting, a fitting that was at the top of the retractable landing gear very, very important component that holds the landing gear in place, and had been damaged and cracked as part of this. And the landing gear was not secure. Very, very dangerous situation to be in. Reached out to his partner. Oh, you know, I did have a bit of a hard landing. And I guess it felt like a little bit of a little weird when I was taxiing back, but I didn't think anything of it. This is really, really important stuff. Above all else, we'll talk about different things having to do with the gear, but above all else, if you have a hard landing, we need to inspect what might have happened to the aircraft. It can, especially if it involves a nose gear, it is less common on mains, but it can happen on both. We want to look for wrinkles, cracks, damage, anything that could happen that could have hurt something there, because this can really bite the next person.
So where would you see that? Would it just be like the gear connect points, or would you see a wing problem or strut? Where's the weak spot?
So it would have to be a really serious landing before it starts affecting other things like wings and struts, etc. The most common thing that you're going to see, because in most aircraft, this isn't exposed. It's a little more exposed than something like your Citabria, but in a lot of aircraft, it's fairly fared up, as it were. Yeah. And so you're looking for what's around it. You're looking for wrinkles in the skin. You're looking for things in front of the doors, let's say, around your firewall area, anything that looks odd. But some of it is this, that's more of your pre-flight, right? Or a post-flight if you're looking at it yourself. If you know that something happened, you can take the time to get a mechanic over and have them take a look. And with a borescope, you may not even have to take anything or much apart. So there's not a ton that you might have to take apart to take a look at. But if it's pre-flight, that's a little more difficult because you don't know what happened before.
Yeah. I wish I could put like a G-meter NARC on the air, you know, someone that records G-meters like in your, or some airplanes probably do that. You know,
record the
load, and you could go back and download the data like a flight data recorder and see, has this airplane, you know, exceeded any limits on landing?
There are. Now, the other thing that really kind of gives things away in many cases is going to be your tires. Yeah. I tell people that one of the most important things that you have to do on pre-flight that I wish more people did is move the aircraft. I see so many people do a pre-flight, get in and taxi out.
So that's funny you say that. I'm going to interrupt you. I'm sorry for interrupting, but it's a really cool story. That when I'm teaching, I demand that my students pull the airplane out and inspect the full circumference of the tires, all of the tires, all the way around. But I didn't do it for the purpose of looking at the tires. I was trying to prevent them from ever trying to taxi away a tied down airplane.
Good point.
That's the end result I was looking for. But as it turns out, from what you're saying, that seems like a pretty good technique to inspect all the way around the tires. Usually the part you need to see might be hidden.
A lot of things can happen based on that. I know we've had shows on pre-flight. I don't want to go too far into that, but there are other benefits, right? You can tell if the tire is sitting in a pool of hydraulic fluid that you didn't realize when you do something like that. You can get closer and see if there's issues. But especially with a fared tire, right? If you don't move it and look as the tire rotates, you can't see if there's a really serious issue with that tire. And so it is very important to move it to see that, to see if there's any flat spots, other issues that are going on. By the way, if you do move it, it will also help during that process of setting up the plane. It'll help really just sitting-based flats. I'll be careful about the terminology, but essentially a temporary flattening of the tire that happens when it just sits in the same place for a week or more. Who knows how long the plane is set.
I've felt that. I think it's worse when it's colder out.
Very much so.
Square tire syndrome, yeah.
Exactly. Womp, 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 womp. Yeah, like you want to know that that's normal. Well, the best way to get rid of that, or at least start the process, is if you're going to be pre-flighting, loading, and all these things for, you know, 15 minutes, 30 minutes on the ground, who knows what's happening, why not roll it and have that flat start easing itself out before you get in and you start doing that?
Makes sense.
So I think that's important.
Yeah. And plus, you won't be tied down when you try to taxi away. No one's ever done that.
Right. There won't be chocks in front of it that you go unless you roll it and then put chocks in. Here's You'll the learn. Cautionary tale.
Now, is this what you're talking about? You sent me this picture. Is
boom.
This,
there you go. That's a flat spot. No question. I'll get to, I'll tell you a little bit about what to look for in those in a second. But I want to point out one quick thing, which I have seen and goes to our ground handling concerns.
Yeah.
And that is, here's what I've seen a bunch of times that worries me. People who do move the plane so that they can do a pre-flight, and somewhere in that process, they leave the plane pulled forward. They are no longer in a safe location for taxiing aircraft. Hmm. And I've seen people leave to go to the bathroom, go meet someone at the gate and let them in. And I've seen planes get hit. I've seen propellers get hit by a wing of something taxiing by because the plane was pulled forward by like 4 feet. Or more out of where it's supposed to be, and then essentially abandoned and left there. Like, please move the plane, but don't leave it in an exposed area. That's really important.
That's a good point. Then the poor soul that goes taxiing by on the taxiway with their nose wheel perfectly on the center line, thinking they're safe because their nose wheel is on the center line. Boom.
Yes.
Yeah.
Good point. So you have the service bulletin up. I want to point people to a specific service bulletin that is available from the FAA and is really helpful. Now, this is more general in nature, but it's kind of cool that it exists out there. And that tells you what to look for on a tire, when a tire is okay and when a tire really needs to be retired from service. And that's that one right there, 2097B. That is kind of all about traditional tire maintenance practices. And if you go to it has a page 6 that'll talk to you about, it'll go into detail about the things to look for about what's
service
and what's not okay. That's exactly right. In service inspections. I don't know if it allows you to zoom in on that, but oh, perfect. And one thing has to do with I don't really particularly like the way they break this down because they sort of say tread damage removal recommendations and versus tire removal, you know, one is in theory if you're going to fix tread damage. But at the end of the day, you don't want to see the underlying belts. You don't want to actually see the plies, the bias plies that are underneath in that fabric, that image that you showed earlier. If you want to go back to that, that's the key.
So that's interesting. I've never seen that service bulletin. So that's targeted to mechanics. Pilots never get to see something like that. I've never seen it.
Well, you can. I wish that more pilots would read service bulletins that are general service bulletins that are out there.
Yeah, but especially for the airplanes they fly. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, the sipes, right? The grooves that you have in a tire are important for water. That's what they're there for displacement of water to keep you from hydroplaning. And so it is true that if you're going to be landing in contaminated runways and in water, then you should also be retiring a tire if it's no longer going to have the ability to displace water. However, that's, you know, not nearly as important as what the mechanical integrity of the tire actually is. And in this case, you're seeing a tire that has extreme wear on the outsides, which is generally due to underinflation. You really want to see your wear happen more towards the center of the tire and a healthy tire. But the minute you start to see this, you know, inner casing of the tire, that definitely has to be removed. Now, another thing that people see is cracking. And I get a lot of questions about cracking, and that one's on the other end of the spectrum a bit. You might be surprised that sort of dry weather cracking of a tire is actually fairly acceptable. What you're looking for here is to make sure that the cracks do not appear to be going deep enough to reach what's called the buff line of the tire. There's multiple levels to a tire in the way that they're manufactured. And actually, you might have an image of that, I think.
The buff line?
And someone just pointed out, yes, it's an AC, and this advisory circular. I was calling it a service bulletin. Here's some cracking, weather cracking. This is perfectly acceptable. Now, I mean, ideally, would your tire be brand new and not look like this? Yeah, sure. It's going to wear more at this weight. But even if you have cracks inside the actual grooves, as long as they're not going and penetrating down further to what's called the buff line or the cushion of the tire, you're really okay. And so that if there's another image that you have there that shows the makeup of the tire. And the way that tires are made, they have these plies, as you can see there, and then they're calling it here undertread. And there's this thing, I think they also sort of show it as that gray area that they're calling breaker in this one. But most in the industry, they usually call it buff lining cushion. And if you look at when tires are retread, they grind off whatever's left of the tread on the tire down to this softer rubber. You're still above the plies, and it's this softer rubber. It has a different consistency. It's more spongy, and that's what you really don't want to be penetrating into at that point. And obviously, that first one that showed the plies were well into that territory in that particular image. But you actually can tolerate a fair amount of cracking on the tire.
Yeah, interesting. Wow.
So again, cracks there, even at the bottom of the grooves, going in some is okay. The grooves do not extend all the way in to that buff and cushion, buff lining cushion. In fact, if you look at the right side of this image, you sort of see that there's a fair amount of real tread rubber that is even past the bottom of those grooves.
How about this?
Yes,
Okay.
exactly. You see how you've got a little bit there before you get down underneath it.
Yeah, so if the groove goes away, then you're on the edge. You're down to this stuff here, right?
Yes, and you're still okay there. We just don't want you getting below that to the part that's just above the plies. When they retread a tire, you're not all the way down seeing plies everywhere like that. They wouldn't retread that kind of a tire.
Gotcha.
You're going above that. And I've always been taught that sidewall, you really shouldn't have cracks in the sidewall. And yet, when I talked to the manufacturers recently, they have specifically told me it's actually okay as long as it again is not penetrating in anywhere near where the plies are, as long as they're still surface, essentially. So that's a little different than what
That's
I was
interesting.
taught,
I'm a
but
wimpy
that's what they're
conservative.
saying.
Yeah, I'm a wimpy conservative dude. I see that on my tires. I just buy new ones. And
Yeah. And I'm
not
with
that I'm
you on
throwing.
that. I'm still going with what I was taught. If the sidewall shows cracking, I
Yeah.
generally get rid of it. But they've said again, as long as you're not near the plies, you're actually okay.
Okay. 'Cause maybe I'm a little too conservative because I've had motor homes where you don't ever do enough miles on the motor home or a camper to wear the tread out. They time out before they actually wear out, and the time sometimes can be indicated by the crack. So I didn't know if that was something that was telling me, hey, it's time to replace. So I had no guidance on that, but I think that advisory circular is one that I'll add to my collection now.
Yeah. Now, the other thing that's so important, I touched on this a bit, just a minute ago, and that is your air pressure. And so we've got a chart here which shows you some interesting things. Air pressure changes radically in a tire compared to what you're used to on your car in an aircraft tire. And we're talking primarily for our audience, we're talking about tires with tubes. And so if you go to the image that we have about aircraft tire markings, there's something interesting about this, and that is, a lot of people don't necessarily know. You've got these green dots going around your tire, and those are your vents. Those are actually little holes that go through there because your tire has the ability of letting air out through that, and there's a certain amount of bleed that also happens inside the tube. Based on just temperature changes, you can have as much as easily a 10% change in tire pressure just by a temperature swing. And this is really, really important because when you lose tire pressure, you could spin the tire, you can put excess heat on it, you're wearing it at different locations. So I'd encourage people, please check your tire pressure very frequently, and address it before you go and you fly.
Yeah, there's a, I don't know if I remember, it was Egypt Air or somewhere in Africa, an accident that killed 200 people on a, I think a 707, all because they pencil whipped the tire pressure, didn't have time to actually fill the tires, they didn't have an air compressor, and they just figured they'd get at the next stop, but it caused so much heat, it started a fire when the wheels got in the well, burned through the hydraulic lines, killed everybody on board. Bad news. And you'd told me about these green dots, which I don't know how many countless times I've pre-flighted, airplane wheels and never noticed those on the tires. And now I see them every time. They're there. And the red balance mark as well.
Especially if you change a tire and you put a new tube in, that's going to be bleeding out any of the trapped air in there for days before it really completely.
Really? Wow. Yeah. Yeah. I won't be changing a tire. Yeah. I'll be calling you. Yeah.
The balance mark that's shown on here is supposed to be the light part of the tire. So that matches the light part of the tire. When you do balance the tire, you should put that on along in line with the valve stem, which is theoretically the heavy part of the tube. That said, we'll talk in another show all about balancing. We're doing a lot of work on that here at Approach Aviation, and it doesn't always add up. So that's one also to know. And then I know time is starting to get tight on the show, but I do want to address vibration and shimmy, mm-hmm. especially if you're having problems with this on takeoff or landing, and of course if you've had a hard landing or something like that. And this is really, really important stuff, because I view shimmy and looseness in landing gear components as a disease. It's a virus. It will, if you allow this to continue, it will infect all sorts of other components very quickly. You need to find the root part of the problem, solve it, and then solve everything else that tightens up a system, because it is a system. And a lot of times people are thinking, oh, my tire's just out of balance, or oh, my shimmy damper isn't doing its job. Shimmy damper there is to mask, essentially, and help contain a problem that in an ideal world wouldn't exist.
But I am so glad to hear you saying this, because I have insisted on getting this repaired on my aircraft, where it went through an annual and they said, oh, that's normal. Just keep the weight off of it until you're slower on landing. And I'm like, I don't know. I don't like it. It doesn't seem right.
And my right foot hurts, doctor. Don't walk on your right foot.
Right. Yeah, no, I'm glad to hear that. It justifies the feeling that I had that this needs to be fixed. I shouldn't just put up with it.
Yeah, if you have a shimmy problem, the shimmy damper is not your problem. I'll tell you that right now. You have to fix it, because it is the damper for everything else going on. Mm. But at the same time, you need to get to the root of the problem. You need to find out, is your steering tight? Are your linkages tight? Or should they be changed? Bushings, bearings, rod ends, what else needs to be fixed? Is your tire out of round? Is your tire out of balance? What else could be happening that's causing all of this? And then when you're comfortable that it's all back to being in really good shape, make sure your shimmy damper is serviced properly, and that will prevent any other undue stress going on your system. But again, I have seen people fix one part of the problem, and then it will rewear right back in, because they left the other parts unattended to.
Wow. Yeah, I had, as it turns out, with my tailwheel, the shimmy was caused by over-tightening.
Mm, interesting.
And once I did lose my wheel, I think we talked about this on the first Cockpit to Cal, I showed a picture of my tailwheel. I didn't used to check my tire pressure. I do it before every flight now, especially when the temperature changes drastically, because it's that big a deal. The longer I go without flying, also I'll check it more. I'm more likely to check it, because it may have been sitting there leaking for longer.
Yeah, and you actually had a flap because of one of these. So yeah.
I did on landing. I couldn't keep the airplane going straight because, and this wasn't, it was no wind. It wasn't, or poor pilot technique. I got out of the airplane, looked at it, and there was the tire off the wheel on the tailwheel.
Crazy. And you know, I'll say that this is one of those things, I get a big smile on my face when I think about really good mechanics. And a really good mechanic will be creative and relentless, or relentless and creative. And that is, you can look at things like hinge points in nose gear. You know, you've got that like the knee joint, the torque links that are in our landing gear. And you look for it for play or things like that. And I've found great mechanics that showed me, hey, here's this material that I use, and I just cut it into a shim and take out the play. I had a really good friend of mine, Dave Pasquale, recently that helped me with that when I was trying to get a little play out of the nose gear of mine. And he's like, oh, I get these little peel washers and material that I use. Matter of fact, I think I have a little piece of stuff here, where you go and you get really thin, like brass shim material, right? Little thin stuff. And you cut it into a washer and you put it in there to tighten something up. There's nothing wrong with
Really?
that. Yeah.
Wow.
And you wind up with something that doesn't have any more play, and all of a sudden it's like night and day. I don't have any
Fascinating.
shimmy issue anymore, and it
That's
wasn't the
fantastic.
damper that I changed.
Wow. You know what makes me smile? No, not that. Pilots who land on the center line. You know what the center line's for, don't you, on the runway?
Tell me.
It's for professional pilots.
Ah.
Soon as I say that, my students will start landing on the center line every time. Don't tolerate being off to the side.
I like that. That's wonderful. Well, Brian, we managed in a heartbeat to land at the end of the show again.
I feel like we've been talking for 10 minutes. Crazy.
We could go on and on and on, but yeah, this has been a ton of fun. What are we going to talk about next time?
Well, I don't know, but I know at some point we need to address all the fantastic questions we're getting. A lot of them we're getting, and we've been answering some of them, but we have so many more that I think we should dedicate an entire podcast or show to just going through the questions that the ones that are repeating, often because more people than one are asking them. So,
Yeah, send your questions in, and one of these shows coming up, we will take some questions and let you grill us a little bit and see where it goes from there. But
yeah.
we will be back. We're back next when May. May's our next show. May 13th, we'll be here for our next Cockpit to Cal show. That's 8 p.m. Tuesday, May 13th. But we've got a lot more happening between now and then. One of my favorite shows, absolutely out there, the Shift Show, is this Thursday, 8 p.m. Eastern Time, 7 p.m. Central. I can go through all the time zones. The Shift Show, Mike Jesch is going to be on. Is that true?
Yeah, Mike Jesch will be here talking about a World War II accident that is still teaching us a valuable lesson today, despite the technology that we have. It'll be a fascinating show and an evening that will prove to be full of Schiff
Well,
and
we'll keep
Jesch.
doing it. Schiff and Jesch.
Yes.
Yep, we'll be back with Social Flight Live is back next Tuesday, April 15th. Boy, do we have a fun show there. Aviation accident analysis and reporting with Juan Brown of Blancalorio will be there on the show. He is so great. I have a lot of respect for him. And we're going to talk about responsible aviation incident reporting
Oh my gosh.
and
Yeah.
how he does that, some of the wonderful ways of doing that. So Juan Brown on that show. And then Tuesday, April 22nd on Social Flight Live, check this one out. We have Theodore Teddy Santos, the project lead on the Mars Ingenuity helicopter. That's right. We've got Jet Propulsion Laboratories coming
Oh,
on.
cool. That's
And you
awesome.
talk about aviation. How about aviation on Mars? And they're going to tell us from the front lines, they did this. He flew that helicopter, was part of that project all the way through. We're going to get his story on Social Flight
Well,
Live.
that's amazing. I look forward to seeing that.
Yeah, that was I'm pretty excited. I kind of want to attend that one just as an attendee. I'm trying to see if
Right.
I can make that happen.
And if you're going to the Great Alaska Aviation Gathering, I'll be there. Look for me in 3 weeks on May 1st, 2nd, 3rd that weekend. I'll be giving a rust a actually, I'll be giving a four flight workshops right after the AOPA Rusty Pilots workshop seminar.
Excellent. Well, listen, thank you to everyone for joining us this evening. Again, go thank all the partners you see back here on my board. And if you're an Avemco customer, go tell them use Social Flight, you get 5% off. But Brian, thank you for everything that you have taught me to make me a better pilot, help me grease some landings someday.
Well, thank you, Jeff, for teaching me as well. As a pilot and aircraft owner, you're an invaluable resource to have. There's just so much that one would never know. Things I never dreamed of. I'm constantly learning, so that's awesome. And I'm glad that we can get online and use this forum to give back and share with everybody who wants to listen to us, chatter about these things, but also learn from us.
Great. Thanks, everybody. We will make sure that you all get your wings credits, and then we'll also get this program up on socialflight.com, where you can go to the FAA credit section and see all of our shows and take them for wings credit, along with tons and tons of other education that's all available on Social Flight. Until next time, I'm Jeff Simon, and I wish you all, for me, blue skies.
Good night, everyone.